Good morning.
Good morning.
For those of you that are on Zoom, we're having a half-day sitting today, so some of us are in the Zendo. So I'll be hopefully connecting with people in the Zendo and also those of you online, okay? Today, I want to talk a little bit about ritual. As many of you know, last week, Shinshu and I were in Eugene, Oregon, taking part in Shinsan Chiki, which is, we call mountain seat ceremony, or ascending the mountain, the installation of our friend Ejo McMullen as abbot of the Buddha Eye Temple in Eugene. The weekend started with a community meal, out in the grass. It was really nice. And then was filled with rehearsals and ceremonies and rehearsals and ceremonies and rehearsals and ceremonies for those of us that were in the ceremonies. So we'll post a few pictures on the website. Yeah. So it was a very lively weekend. And I want to mention that because sometimes people think that Zen rituals, especially done in a traditional Japanese context, are grim or rigid. Anybody of you ever had that thought? Anybody here ever had that thought? I don't know where that got started, but it is so far from the truth. Just as an example, this weekend, these rituals were alive with friendship and intention to give our best, most focused, and heartfelt effort together, leading and following, engaging fully, paying close attention to one another, little hand gestures. You know, we all had masks on for the whole time, so the facial things was a little harder to read. There was one young monk there who, you know, really got a lot of gusto, young, one of Ejo's students, a lot of gusto. And that was the way he was expressing his sincerity. But he tended to go ahead of, you know, when we were processing out, those of us that had certain roles were processing out, he'd be like, go ahead, and we'd like, no, the point is, we do this together. And he was like, okay. So, it was warm-hearted and precise at the same time. One of the rituals that some of us did is fanning the sutras. So, the thinking is that we bring out these sutras and fan them like this, like an accordion. This brings the energy of the sutras into the room and out into the world. So there are several aspects to this ritual. It forms a kind of mandala, like our service here in the Zendo. There's a central priest, in this case Ejo, who was doing a whole lot of ritual stuff. And then there were a line of us along each side who were going to be fanning the sutras, and then there were another body of people, a pretty large body of people, including many of our Dharma friends. So the way it worked is we had the stack of sutras, a sutra in a number of volumes wrapped in a brocade box kind of thing. And we chanted the sutra and at one point we opened it up together. So there were, eight of us doing this part. We opened it up at the same time. And then we chanted the name of the sutra. And we would, together, but not in unison, and loudly. So it's kind of like, whoa, you know. And then we pick up the first book and touch it to our forehead, and then right shoulder, left shoulder, and then do the fanning. Right? Back and forth. Forward, backwards. And then our leader in this, we listen and watch together when we would stop the fanning, and then we would say something again really loudly, and then place that down and pick up the next book until we went through all of them. So, we were putting our intention quite deeply and clearly into doing what we were doing with the intention of blessing the space, bringing the sutra forward, sending it out into the world. And we were very practically grounded with each other, watching what we were doing, unifying our action. This kind of lively, engaged, concrete action with a spiritual intention. So I think this is important, and one of the reasons I want to talk about this is that ritual is both vast and specific. It's both unfathomable and concrete. We put ourselves wholly in it, whatever our role is. We put ourselves wholly in it, and we're also just quite simply humans together. So our intention is clear. We have a sense of kindness and ordinariness. And if we lose that sense, that kind of dual sense, then we lose the practice of it. When we engage in ritual, we are changed. Each of us is never apart from our environment. We are an interdependent event, an expression of reality unique to each moment, arising from multiple factors, stretching back in time, out in all directions, and tied directly to the future. Who we are is interwoven with all of reality, arises in concert with all of reality. So what this means is that we are impacted, shaped, changed by what we do, how we do it, where we do it. This is always true. A ritual simply engages us in this in a specific way. I was thinking about, we drove up Eugene, and I was thinking about how the land changes, you know, from the golden hills of California up, and through this beautiful high desert, beautiful high desert, and then into the green. And I was thinking about the original peoples of these lands. Here are the Awasas and the Ohlone peoples. And if we remember that this is their land, if we look in our environment and we remember this is their land, something happens to us, doesn't it? Aren't we changed in some way? I hope so. So how we experience ourselves in our environment, how we understand that, changes who we are. Same thing we can say, what happens when we pay attention to the physical aspects of our lives and remember that, as Dogen Zenji tells us, if we treat one leaf of green as Buddha, Buddha is manifest through that leaf of green, benefiting all beings. He tells us this in the Tenzo Kyokan. You handle one piece of lettuce, one green bean, one artichoke, I don't know. Manifests Buddha in our lives. One of the ways that we talk about this in terms of ritual is katakahairu, meaning entering through form. Entering through form. So we place ourselves in a ritual in a certain context. We place ourselves in that. We enter into an action or an environment with a willingness to be changed. We enter into a form knowing that we are a co-constituted event with that form, and therefore we will be changed by it. We want to be changed by it. We are willing to be changed, transformed, shaped. And how we're shaped, we can't plan. We don't have a set idea. We enter into a form and we might think, oh, I'm going to feel holy, or I'm going to feel calm, or I'm going to feel whatever. But we don't know. We entrust ourselves to that. We enter fully into that as a trustworthy process. We may never know how we're changed, but we can have a spirit of inquiry about it. We can take the posture of wondering, what is happening here? Who am I now? And who is it that's asking that question in the first place? The response that we feel to that question may come in unexpected ways. It's not a matter of answering the question. Any answer we will come up with is incomplete. But asking is our path. We are an imperfect mix of narrative, gifts, talents, wounds, limitations. We are an expression of life itself, and never other than the whole of reality. We live at that intersection. The Saha world, this world, is our world. It's a tricky business, don't you think? Don't you think? It's a tricky business, this intersection. So we take care of our lives, our minds, and our hearts. We take care of the world. We are aware of the particularity of this one and our identity with the vastness. And in ritual, this comes alive in a certain way. It makes concrete, in a sense, our commitment to our path of practice. When we sit zazen, we sit down and remember ourselves. We remember ourselves, we recall ourselves, we remember ourselves. And then we get up and forget. I say this again and again. Yeah. We are always on a journey of remembering moment after moment after moment and acting to benefit all beings. Entering through form, bringing ritual alive together in the Zendo and in our daily lives, in our weekly services, in major ceremonies, is a way of supporting, investigating, engaging, transforming who we are. One way to do this that I've spoken of before, but I decided I wanted to speak of again, is the practice of having a home altar. We can go to these major ceremonies like a mountain seat. We can come here and chant together. This is really a wonderful way of experiencing ourselves as a Sangha together, but also, and then if we step out into these bigger ceremonies where we're with people from all over, doing something once in a lifetime ceremony. This is really good. But what do we do at home? At a home altar, we remember what matters to us, what helps us remember who we are, how we want to be guided in our lives. When we stand or sit in front of our home altar, we are touched by what is there. It is woven in with the narrative and the day-to-day life. So, we can have altars everywhere, right? At work, in our car, our home altar is considered a small version of this altar. Mount Sumeru, the mountain on which Buddha resides. So, just mention a few things again about what is traditionally on a home altar. It's an image of Shakyamuni Buddha, which is generally central and elevated. Could be a statue, could be a scroll. You might have both. Sometimes you have a picture of Dogen Zenji or Keizan Zenji or memorial tablets, images of our ancestors, deceased loved ones on either side of the Buddha. Offerings can be made. Incense, flowers, lavender buds, candles, light, water, tea, food. Remember, if you offer food, eat it afterwards because you don't want anything to go to waste. The Buddha can eat it and leave it at the same time. So it's like having your cake and eating it too, right? The same with water or tea, or they can be offered to animals or plants. Usually flowers are on the left and the candles on the right. Incense are in the middle. And you might have down below a sutra book, a mala, a bell, a drum. Also, if you receive a gift, it's often to put it on the altar, to offer it to Buddha first. So, for example, a few weeks ago, Liz Horowitz, who is the widow of our teacher, Hakuryu Sojun Daiyosho, Mel, Mel sent us a donation for our temple, and Liz mailed it to us, and first thing, it goes on the altar. So, that's a nice thing to do. Somebody gives you a gift, put it on the altar. But all of this is completely flexible, okay? You got that? Maybe you have a statue of Kenon, or Jizo, or a rock. The point is to make this real for yourselves, to make it a place where you bring yourself, a place of encouragement, support, inspiration. You can put pictures of people that inspire you or help you remember. I have pictures of my teachers on my altar, my family. Maybe you put a little phrase up there or a little book. You might put some fun things on your altar. You don't need to be serious all the time. So, the altar functions as a cornerstone. We put our hands together in gassho. We're expressing reverence and gratitude for the teachings that sustain us and the many beings, people, and other animals who carry the teachings forward, our family, the natural world. In that place, in that environment, in that specific place, we remember we are sustained. We feel our specific personal engagement with the world through our practice. We dedicate ourselves to this life in this way. In all of our stumbling, messy efforts, we bring ourselves to this place at this time with this body and this mind and this heart. This is a power place, as they say, you know? This is a place of power, Buddha power, that takes root and sustains us and our work in the world. You can chant the refuges or simply remain silent, sit zazen, dance, sing. I don't know. Wear a tutu. You know?
Play a kazoo.
Huh?
Play a kazoo.
Yeah. We can take the time to reflect on our daily lives in the way I described in my last Dharma talk. Or just recall what we're grateful for, what we rely on. Recall what sustains and inspires us. Maybe what we want to bring to life, our intention. We can also express our worries and our griefs, our complaints and our stresses. If we bring darkness to our lives, in our lives to such a place, we have a chance to see it in a new light. Engaging in ritual in this way is life-giving. It is not about rigidity. It is about being precise. You know, when we're here together, I mean, imagine if we had been doing the, you know, it's a little tricky. And when you're really good, the fanning of the sutras, you can, like, really make it big. You know, I'm not that good yet, so mine was more. Because if you don't do it, it'll just fly all over the place. And then it becomes like this accordion gone bonkers, right? And that's okay, too, you know. If that happens, you just put it back together and keep going. But just say, instead of touching the sutra to my head, I decided to touch it to Shinshu's head. Or, you know what I'm trying to say? We're precise in what we do because we care. If you're doing a recipe, you don't just decide to put a cup of oregano in. You know? Well, maybe you do if you really like oregano. But the point is, you're precise in what you do because you care about what you're doing. Not out of fear or judgment, out of love, out of caring. And you do it with other people. You pay attention with other people for the same reason. And it brings it into this concrete reality. So I encourage you to think about this in your lives. In our rituals here, and also in your home. Create a place like this. Return to it regularly. Support yourself, your practice, your involvement in the world. And grow your taste buds for the richness and the fundamentally grounded nature of ritual. I don't know if we grow taste buds, but yeah, I read somewhere, oh, I know, this is quite funny. I heard a commercial on the radio for a place to buy hamburgers. And they said, you grow new taste buds every week. So if you don't eat one of their hamburgers during a week, your poor taste bud has died without ever having the taste of their hamburger. I thought, this is a great way to think about our practice. You know? We want this body and mind to be alive to the practice, and so we return to it regularly, and then we also have these big blowout ceremonies where we celebrate something that happens once in a life. So please enjoy the ritual. Enjoy your lives.